Welcome to the CDH Conversations podcast and welcome to all of our listeners. Our podcast will deal with the controversial and much talked about recent judgment of West Coal Mining and another versus Nkombo and others, as well as various other ancillary aspects stemming from the judgment. I would first like to welcome and introduce our speakers for this discussion. Starting with myself, I'm Kylene Veyers and I'm a director in the Dispute Resolution Department at Cliffdekker Hofmeyr, specializing in business rescue, restructuring and insolvency. We have Gideon Slabbert, a business rescue practitioner at Corporate Business Rescue Advisory and a board member of the Turnaround Management Association of South Africa. Our next speaker is Juliet de Hutton, who is a director and the co-head of restructuring at Bowman Gilfillan. And last but not least, we have Prof. Andre Berain, who is an internationally renowned insolvency academic. The podcast will briefly deal with the following topics. Firstly, we will discuss the implications of the West Coal Mining judgment. We will take a look at the position of trade creditors post the commencement of business rescue proceedings. We will consider how claims must be proven in business rescue proceedings and whether there are any timeline restrictions in submitting these claims. And lastly, we will look at a comparative approach in international jurisdictions on the principles of a post-commencement creditor. So let's jump straight into a brief overview of the facts of the West Coal judgment. The crux of the case revolved around the scope and interpretation of the term creditor as it appears in Chapter 6 of the Companies Act, which we know governs business rescue proceedings. The judgment was based on statutory interpretation, as the Companies Act itself does not explicitly define the term creditor. The court therefore needed to grapple with the issue of defining who qualifies as a creditor with voting rights during the business rescue process, which of course has a major bearing on whether a business rescue plan will ultimately be adopted or rejected. The court specifically needed to decide whether post-commencement creditors have voting interests and whether they have the legal right to vote on the approval or rejection of a business rescue plan. Now, turning to the court's finding, the judgment concluded that post-commencement creditors, which includes post-commencement financiers, are not creditors, as defined in Chapter 6 of the Companies Act, and therefore cannot vote on a business rescue plan. The judge found that only pre-commencement creditors should have voting rights in business rescue proceedings. In other words, only those persons who were creditors when the business rescue proceedings commenced, he found, are entitled to vote on a business rescue plan. Post-commencement creditors were effectively placed in a completely different category. Now, taking a look at the implications of this judgment on future business rescues, I think that whether or not you agree with the legal reasoning of Judge Wilson in reaching his judgment, most people can agree that the practical implications of this judgment are very problematic. Although I do credit the judge for trying very diligently and meticulously to interpret the Companies Act, I believe that the judgment failed to take into account the commercial realities of business rescue. There are far-reaching commercial implications of excluding post-commencement creditors from voting on the outcome of the business rescue plan. And importantly, there are serious repercussions for post-commencement financing, which is a critical element for the successful turnaround of financially distressed companies. Post-commencement financiers are the essential providers of lifeblood to a company in business rescue. And so we want to make it as attractive as possible for post-commencement financiers to provide funding to distressed companies. But by depriving all post-commencement financiers of a vote and by excluding them from the voting process, it will undoubtedly discourage post-commencement financiers from providing the essential finance to distressed companies going forward. And this is likely to change the financing landscape for companies in business rescue in the future. Now, for me, it does not make business sense to limit the voting rights of post-commencement financiers to vote on the outcome of the very business that they have invested in. And I think, unfortunately, the judge focused more on a theoretical interpretation of the legislation rather than on the practical consequences of such an interpretation. I believe that the practical ramifications of the judgment is that, unfortunately, it creates an environment that is potentially detrimental to the very objective of business rescue, which is the efficient rescue of financially distressed companies. And the judgment therefore impacts on the prospects of future successful business rescues in our country. And from my side, it is hoped that this is not the last time that we will hear on this judgment. I'd now like to hand over to Gideon Slabbert, who will consider the position of trade creditors in light of this judgment.
Yes, thank you, Kylene. Firstly, greetings to all our listeners and my fellow panelists this morning. As a practicing business rescue practitioner, it is my view that the fraternity needs clarity and legal certainty in regards to voting interest assigned to creditors when voting on the adoption of a proposed business rescue plan. When we revert to the Companies Act, Section 1454 states the following: in respect of any decision contemplated in this chapter that requires the support of holders of creditors' voting interest, a secured or unsecured creditor has a voting interest equal to the value of the amount owed to that creditor by the company. The Westcourt judgment concluded that only creditors at the commencement of business rescue proceedings is afforded a voting interest. It leaves a group of creditors that afforded credit to the company after the commencement of business rescue and not dealt with as a statutory preferent creditor as referred to in Section 135 of the Act in the DAO. In practice, we need the assistance of suppliers, service providers, and the like to provide credit to the company to ensure ongoing trade of the company when in business rescue. Without these creditors, the company is doomed and post-commencement trade becomes very challenging. So at this stage, business rescue practitioners must be very diligent in how they deal with the creditor groups in a proposed business rescue plan. And they need to ensure that no stone remains unturned for business rescue practitioners, and they need to consult their legal advice when drafting a business rescue plan. I will now hand over to Ms. Juliet.
Thanks, Gideon. There are two issues that I want to raise. First, in the course of his judgment, the judge expressed the view that creditors and other affected persons are those affected by the commencement of the business rescue process itself, and that affected persons are therefore the creditors, employees, and the shareholders that existed at the commencement of the proceedings. I'm afraid that I take issue with this, and to me what the judge overlooks is the fact that business rescue contemplates that the company will continue to operate, and consequently the creditors, the employees, and indeed even the shareholders of the companies could and actually do change during the course of the process. So to limit affected persons to those who were in existence at the commencement of the process is not logical. Particularly in relation to creditors, there's no concursus creditorum in the same way that there is for a liquidation. And because the company will continue to require goods and services and perhaps post-commencement finance, there can be a lot of movement in the creditor body during the business rescue process. That is both in relation to who the creditors are and how much is owing to them. The second point I want to raise is that if one reads the judgment and also have a look at the papers that were filed in this application, issues relating to the proof of claims and voting interests arise. And in this regard, it's worth mentioning that the Companies Act contains absolutely nothing that indicates how claims should be proved by creditors or even that claims are required to be proved at all. However, it is usual for practitioners to require creditors to prove claims and to stipulate the format of those claims. And most practitioners require that creditors submit claims in the same way or in the similar format as in liquidation proceedings. And it's also usual for practitioners to provide a deadline by which all claims must be submitted. I don't believe it's problematic for a practitioner to prescribe deadlines or the format in which claims should be prepared. However, in my view, a practitioner must always act in a fair and reasonable manner, and timelines therefore must be clearly communicated to creditors, and those timelines must be reasonable. So, for example, if a claim is submitted post the deadline, but there's a reasonable explanation for this, then in my view, the claim should still be considered by the practitioner. And similarly, claims shouldn't be rejected simply because there's an insignificant technical defect. And the practitioner should probably reserve his rights in this regard in the business rescue plan. The Act also doesn't prescribe a process for the review of claims by practitioners and their acceptance or rejection. And to the extent that creditors submit claims and the practitioner disputes them, the business rescue plan should and always does, in my experience, provide for a dispute resolution process. However, regards determining voting interests, This may take place before all claims have been submitted or before any dispute resolution process has been completed, and there's nothing in the Act to guide a practitioner in determining voting interests in relation to disputed claims. In my experience, to the extent that a practitioner disputes a claim, the creditor is usually not allowed a voting interest, or is only allowed a voting interest to the extent that the claim is undisputed, and the plan provides that this will be the case. If this is unacceptable to any particular creditor, the only recourse available to them is to approach the court to interdict the meeting or to set aside the vote at the meeting. And obviously, this is a very onerous requirement that involves the investment of significant costs and time. Over then to Prof. Bahrain for a comparative approach.
Thank you, Juliet, and good day, everyone. So, well, I think it is safe to say that the Westcol judgment will probably be appealed or another court might come to another conclusion. However, the conclusion of the court is not novel, and the learned authors of Hockley stated well before this judgment and with reference to the voting interest that the word creditor in this context refers to all the pre-commencement creditors because it's the details of their claims that must be set out in the business rescue plan. But since our business rescue procedure has been inspired by some foreign legal systems, and since our courts are allowed to consider foreign law when interpreting our Companies Act, a comparative view may also assist in analyzing the position. So I've scanned 8 jurisdictions, namely Australia, Canada, England, Germany, India, New Zealand, the Netherlands, and the USA. My understanding is that the systems differ in detail and their rescue procedures take different forms. But the broad general principle is that post-commencement finance creditors do not, as a rule, have the right to vote. However, there is a trade-off in that the rights of the PCF creditors are protected in one way or another, in that such a creditor will enjoy a super preference or a payment will be secured otherwise. Notable, however, if the claim is to be restructured, affected, in other words, the PCF creditor must consent. A commentator in India stated, post-commencement financiers do not have a right to vote because their interest is fully protected by the insolvency code. Also notable and relevant to South Africa is where he states that post-commencement finance is yet to grow as an industry in India and it is at a nascent stage. A German expert noted that the right to vote is limited to infringed pre-commencement claims or rights. So, any post-commencement claim must be paid in full or, if restructured, in a fully consensual workout. In the Dutch restructuring framework, named the WUA, the PCF creditors are in principle excluded since the law states that only creditors and shareholders whose rights are changed under the plan can vote. And in principle, that would exclude PCF creditors. In the USA, post-commencement debts like wages are not claims, but these are deemed to be administrative expenses and must be paid in full. Hence, no vote is attached to them. The so-called post-petition financiers also do not vote, but their claims could not be adjusted without their consent. They also protect themselves by means of special credit agreements with protection clauses approved by a court order in terms of their bankruptcy code. An American commentator remarked that their system works well, but it must be understood that it operates in the confines of a well-developed and sophisticated distress financing market. So to conclude, the details of the procedures differ, but where the post-commencement finance creditor has no vote, the claim must be protected by, for instance, granting a special preference. However, where their rights may be affected, they should consent to a possible restructuring. The rule in our law that shareholders will have a vote where the plan may affect their rights embodies this approach. So, in general, one can say the Westcol judgment is broadly in line with some international approaches, but that's not the end of the story. And I think this is perhaps also one area where our business rescue procedure needs to be reviewed. Well, that is my contribution. Thank you. And back to you, Kylene.
Thank you to all the speakers for this insightful discussion and for sharing your views. I think just to wrap up the discussion and the conclusion on the Westcol judgment, Although the court categorically excludes post-commencement creditors from the voting process in business rescue proceedings, the court unfortunately did not go further to provide a framework on how the interest should be otherwise protected or considered. And I think the absence of this guidance from the court may lead to various legal uncertainties in business rescue proceedings going forward. And this unfortunately serves as a stumbling block to the effective financial restructuring of distressed entities in South Africa. It appears that the matter may be taken on appeal, and it can only be hoped that if it is, the current legal position pursuant to this judgment is rectified and clarified. Until such time as any appeal is heard and determined, the current law and position is as it stands in the Westcall judgment, and we are bound to act in accordance with the court's decision. It is therefore advised that all professionals in the business rescue and restructuring industry heed the legal principles and decision as it is laid out in the judgment.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.